Good morning, everybody. My name's Mike Cook, and I'm an alcoholic. And with all my heart, I want to tell you the first thing that I want you to hear from me this morning is I am glad to be sober. You know, it's Sunday morning, and when I say I'm glad to be sober, I'm telling you I am really glad to be sober. And there's a lot of people around here that's glad I'm sober, too. I want to thank the committee and all the speakers this weekend. It's just been a wonderful time for me. I've got something from all the speakers. I found out that June used to read True Confession. And I found out that Yankees do like NASCAR races. And it's a good thing that me and Caritha wasn't stationed in the military together. Because I don't believe they could have stood it. I'm just joking. I tell you what, it's been a great roundup for me. My sobriety date is January the 1st, 1989. I've just celebrated 10 years in this wonderful program. I don't say that to be bragging, although I'm very proud of it. My mother's proud of it. DeKalb County Police was proud of it. Fulton, Gwinnett. From that statement right there, you can tell that I was born and raised here in Georgia. I'm a dying breed. There's not too many of us left. But y'all just keep coming down here because I paint houses for a living, and you're keeping me working. My home group is early Sunday morning. As a matter of fact, it's just ending as I start this talk. Early Saturday morning at the Howe place, and it's the best home group in the world. And if you don't feel that way about your home group, then I think you might ought to think about looking for another one. I'm a little nervous. I always am for the first few minutes. And I heard a little story the other day, and I think it applies to most of the people in this room. And it goes like this. It was a teacher that told her students that she wanted them to give her a story and then give her the moral of the story. And what the first little kid said, my granddaddy used to sell eggs for a living. And one day he had all his eggs and he had gathered them and he started to the truck and he fell and he busted them all. And she said, well, what's the moral of the story? And he said, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Another little kid said, well, my granddaddy used to sell chickens for a living. And he sold 100 chickens and he put 100 eggs in the incubator, but only 75 of them hatched. She said, what's the moral of that story? She said, don't count your chickens before they hatch. Another little boy said, my Uncle Jimmy was in the war, and he's a helicopter pilot, and the helicopter got shot down, and he was the only one with a parachute. And when he came out of the helicopter, he had a machine gun and a machete and a fifth of liquor. And on the way down to the ground, he drank that fifth of liquor. And when he landed in the middle of 100 enemy soldiers. He killed 75 of them with a machine gun. He killed 20 of them with that machete, and he beat the rest of them to death with his head, with his hands. She said, what's the moral of that story? He said, don't mess with my Uncle Jimmy when he's drinking liquor. I just heard that last week. I just thought it was so appropriate. Don't mess with me when I'm drinking liquor. I want to start off by saying that, you know, I didn't come up here this morning to blame anybody for my alcoholism. I'll take responsibility for that. It wasn't my father. My father was an alcoholic, but he was out of my life pretty early on. I grew up in a small town out here in Scottsdale, Georgia, in a mill village. And everybody worked in the mill village out there. And everybody had the same thing, nothing. We had two ditches that went down the side of our road. I lived on the last house. On the right, on this dirt road, there was two ditches run down it to keep the water run off the dirt road. And the outhouses was lined up just like the houses right in back. Some of them had double-seaters and some of them had single-seaters, but everybody had an outhouse. And that's the way I grew up, and it was a rough street. And the further down the road, the rougher you got. And like I told you, I lived on the last house down there. We would fight. I remember one of the worst fights I ever got in my life was over a mayonnaise sandwich. And a mayonnaise sandwich is just like what you're hearing today is two pieces of loaf bread with mayonnaise in it. There's no meat there, not even potted meat, you know. But I grew up in a good home. My mother and my stepfather, my mother remarried, and my stepfather was a wonderful man. He was a good father to me. and I loved him. And I've got, like I said, I've got no blame to put nowhere for my alcoholism other than I drank too much liquor. That's the way I became an alcoholic. And I started off real young with this thing. I started out drinking when I was very young. I really don't remember my first drink. I hope I remember my last one, because I hope the last one that I took over 10 years ago is the last drink that I ever took, that I will ever take. I hear people say, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And if I had anything, you know, my plans wasn't to be an alcoholic. And I'm a little different than that. I used to watch these guys that they used to hang out in front of the company store down at the mill. And they drove nice cars. And they had better looking women than most of the other guys in the town, you know. And they wore better clothes. And they used to wear them leisure suits back years ago, you know, with the big things. And God almighty, I wanted that. You know, I wanted that better-looking girl in that leisure suit and that nicer car. And all these boys, they never worked, you know. And I didn't get it, but I just wanted to be like them, you know. And I found out they was thieving for a living. And they drank liquor all day long, you know. And the more I learned about these boys, the more I wanted to be like them, you know. I started emulating these guys. I started doing all the things that I could do to be just like these boys. And boy, I got there. I'm going to tell you right now. And I got there in a hurry. I had got in so much trouble by the time I was 17 years old with the law. And it was just a bunch of petty stuff. It wasn't nothing serious. I hadn't done anything serious at that time in my life. But I had to go to Macon, Georgia to get a waiver before I could join the Navy. A judge out there in DeKalb County told me at a sentencing one time. He said, son, he said, I'm going to give you a chance in your life. He said, I'm going to either sentence you to 1 year in the Georgia State Penitentiary, or I'm going to let you join the military. Well, now, I know I don't look too smart, but I can guarantee you that if you give me a chance to join the military or go to penitentiary, I'm going to join the military every time. And that's exactly what I did. I went down and I joined the United States Navy, and I got on a big jet out here in Atlanta, and first time I'd ever, only place I'd ever been besides Georgia was Tennessee, and that's not like leaving Georgia, if you know what I mean. I mean, you know. And they flew me to San Diego, California. And boy, when I got out in San Diego, California, I'm going to tell you what. It was unbelievable. I could not believe it. It was like being overseas to me. I had never seen some of the things and the people that I got to meeting out there. You know, it was like people in San Diego, in California just do it a lot different than they do out here. I'm going to tell you. They drive faster, they live faster, and I couldn't tell. I wound up in San Francisco, and I couldn't tell the men from the women, and it was just an unbelievable experience for me. Well, I signed up to go overseas when I got out of boot camp, and I got through boot camp fairly well. I messed up a few times, it wasn't nothing serious, and I signed up to go overseas, and they shipped me to Sasebo, Japan. And if you're an up-and-coming young alcoholic, Sasebo, Japan is where you want to go in 1960, because you could drink over there when you was 17. You could go in any of the bars, and whatever was there for the older men was there for you too. And boy, I took advantage of that. I think I was at my first duty station the whole amount of 3 days, and I was an E2. And at that time, you had to be back on the base by 12 o'clock. They call it Cinderella Liberty. And I got drunk, and I woke up and didn't even know where I was. And I didn't know where the base was. And nobody spoke English around me. And I was kind of getting a little panicky there, because I knew I was going to be in deep trouble if I didn't get back to that base pretty quick. And I remember I started looking for a crane out there that I remembered it. That was in the, you know, Southern people's got a way about directions, you know. You people up north will figure that out if you stay down here long enough. Billy's talking about last night, the furthest he ever drove anywhere was 20 minutes. And you got to drive 20 minutes just to get a Coca-Cola down here, you know. But anyway, I found that base, and that started out my career in the Navy. And I woke up the other morning, and the first thing I thought about is, oh, my God, Caritha's already told the first 10 minutes of my story. She did it in a skirt, and I did it in pants, but we've done the same thing. I had been over there for a little while, and I had got hooked up with this lady, and one night we were at home and at her house, and I told her I had a toothache, and she told me, she said, well, I'll be right back. And she went down to this drugstore. Now, it's against the law for American soldiers or military men to be found in a drugstore, in Japan, because they sell a lot of stuff just right over there. Their counter drugs are like our prescriptions over there. And I told her, I said, I had a toothache. And she went down there to get that medicine, and she brought it back, and I won't never forget it. She broke a little top off of it, and she stuck a straw down in that medicine, and she handed it to me. And there's a little bitty vial like that right there, and she said, "Here, take this." And I took that, and I sucked that medicine up in that straw, and that stuff hit my teeth, and then it hit my throat, and it got down in my stomach, and I couldn't even feel my body, let alone my teeth. And, boy, I like that stuff good, you know. I said, this just beats the hell out of Orajel. All, you know, 2-1. And I told her about 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, I think I told her, I said, "Go down there to the store and get me some of that toothache medicine." And she refused to go because it made me mean. And she said, no, you mean. You mean when you do that. I said, "Well, I'll go myself." So I got up and I got out on the street, and I was walking down a hill. It's pretty hilly over there. And I was walking down a hill with a pair of wooden shoes and a kimono on. And I was having a hard time with them wooden shoes because I'd been in that bottle pretty good. And Shore Patrol pulled up beside me, and they always ride one Marine and one sailor in the truck over there, in the paddy wagon, you know. And the boy looked over, and I kind of glanced over, and I just put my head down. I kept clocking on down the road. And he said, "Boy, where are you going?" I said, "Me no speak English." And I went right to jail. He said, "You got to get in the paddy wagon, son." So the captain told me, he informed me that he had been in the military for about 40 years, and they took pictures of me in that kimono. And he said that he had just never seen a sailor that was in that bad a shape in his life. But I just was not really military stuff. I just, I just did not like. And I never really did anything that you could lock me up for as far as criminally in the United States. Over there I didn't, or while I was in the Navy. But I just didn't follow their rules very well. You know, I was always one of the, I'm real quick out of the box. I'm one of those boys that's, you know, it's like a dog race when those boxes open up. Man, I tell you what, if you won't bet on me for the first 20 yards, I'll get you money every time. But I just never finished nothing. You know, I just could not ever finish nothing in my life. And here I was about 19 years old, and I could not stand the military. I couldn't stand all those. I loved the ocean. I loved being out at sea. I had a captain tell me one time, he said, "You know, you're one of the finest sailors that's ever served under me when you're on this ship." He said, "But boy, you cannot stand that beach. You cannot take it, you know." And he was right, you know. We come back to San Diego, California on a tanker one time, and they were going to put the tanker in dry dock. But they booed it out, and I stayed on restriction all the time. I never had liberty. They just took that away from me because I didn't belong with. They told me I didn't belong with people out there. And I remember they buoyed that ship out in the bay there, and they was all, it was all a standing joke that Mike Cook couldn't get over on the beach this time that they had me, you know. And they got this little old dinghy that they paint the boat, that they paint ships with when they're buoyed out, and you know, I just went out there in the back, and I was watching the beach over there, and they had bonfires going on the beach, and they was playing music, and I knew they was drinking liquor. And, boy, I got to wanting to go over there so bad I couldn't stand it, you know. So I went to the back of that ship, and I lowered that dinghy down in the water, and I rowed that thing over to that party. And I got so drunk, I couldn't row back. So the next morning, they just come over, pick me up, you know. And took me back to the ship. I didn't last long in the Navy. I think I lasted about 2 years, somewhere around there. And about half that time was spent in the brig, to be honest with you. I went in at E2 and I come out at E1. And, you know, I say all this, and it's real funny right now. And when I stand up and give this talk right here, and I know it's funny, it is funny when you say, but I'm going to tell you something. There ain't nothing funny about it when you're going through it. I remember when they handed me that discharge on Treasure Island, I was like you. I thought, you know, now I've signed up for 4 years, and everybody knows that. And everybody in my neighborhood knows that if you come back home early, that something's wrong. You've got some kind of discharge that's not right. You know, you didn't cut it. You quit again. You lost again. You are a loser, you know. And that was my idea. So what I got in my mind that I would do was I'd stay out in California until that 4 years was up, see. That was not a good idea for me. Before I go any further, I will tell you that there's a lot of drugs in my life, but there's a little bit of drugs in my story, but I swear to you, I will not upset a pure alcoholic in this room. I will not do that. I love you. I go to AA meetings. They're the only meetings that I attend. I went to a few meetings, but I get everything I need from this place. I used to introduce myself as I'm Mike Cook and I'm an alcoholic addict. If you don't like that, you can kiss it. You know, that's why I do it, you know, because I didn't want to be here. You know, I'd put that attic in there so I'd make you old-timers mad, you know. And you just sit back there and just shake your head like, we don't care what you are, boy, you know. I told him one time when I went to a meeting, I said, I'll tell you what, I just come back off a slip, and I told him, I said, I'm going to tell you something right now. I'm going to go tomorrow without drinking, but I'm going to smoke a joint. They said, boy, we don't care what you do. I said, I can't even get thrown out of AA. You know. My mother used to tell me, she'd say, son, you know your problem is the way you look. I thought, that's a heck of a thing to tell me. You know, the way you look. What does she mean by that? And she'd say, your problem is the way you look. And I thought she meant my appearance. And I went in there and I looked at myself and I thought, and I wore my hair in a duck's tail. And I had a lot of lard and stuff in it because it's real curly and it's hard to get it back, you know. And I look at myself and I think, well, I think you look pretty good. What she meant was when I looked at these people with disgust and curl that old lip up, you know. And I got my eyes dotted all the time on kind of the way I looked, you know. People would dot my eye for that. But anyway, I finished off that Navy career in short order. It didn't take me very long. And I finished off that idea about staying out in San Francisco when I got out. I got me an apartment in Oakland. I think that lasted about 2 months. I just couldn't cut that no more. And the Navy didn't give me no check, but they gave me a plane ticket. And I did have enough sense to put that plane ticket up just in case I didn't make my fortune in California and I could get home. And I caught that bird, and I come back home. And I thought all the way coming back, I remember I was thinking, now this was at about 19 years old, almost 20 years old. I was thinking all the way back home, I'm going to change my life when I get back. I'm going to quit running around and doing the things that I was doing. I'm going to get away from that old crowd, and I'm going to move in with my mother and stay with her until I can get on my feet. And then I'm going to go out and get me an apartment. You know, and I was going to just do a normal thing. I was going to live like a normal person. Now, I was thinking that at 19 years old, something ought to tell you, if you're thinking that way at 19 years old, there's something bad wrong with you, you know. But I didn't know that. And I came back to Atlanta, and I got downtown to the bus station. And if you've ever been in any big city in a bus station, you know what a bus station's like. There's everything in the world in a bus station. There's the sickest people in the world there. You know, and I just fit right in. And I run up on this boy that was living down there, and he said, buddy, he said, if you'll buy me a beer, I'll show you a good place to drink one. And I remember I had a little money on me, and I said, well, you know, one beer ain't going to hurt. I didn't even get to my mother's house for about 2 weeks. I started drinking then, and that was the history of my drinking. I drank the same way from the time I started until the time that I quit this last time. And that was to drink all I could drink, as hard as I could drink, as long as I could drink, and do anything that I could do to get another drink. That's the way I drank liquor. That's all my life. You know, that was just the way it was. And like I said, I wasn't raised that way. My people didn't do that. I had one family member out of all my uncles and aunts that drank. Well, he had one, and he drank anything, you know. And he was a good guy, but bless his heart, he'd go on a drunk, and he'd go down to the Baptist church where all my family went to church, and he'd go down the aisle, and he'd be drunk, and he'd start talking about people. And he'd say, I seen you over at Joanne's house last night, and, you know, I think you drank a little bit too much liquor. I seen you at the liquor store. And it's bad to tell a Baptist that you seen him in a liquor store, especially while he's in church. And he just run my family right out of the church, you know. And then they'd all get back in, and that was to go on until he died. But anyway, I turned over a new leaf, and it was just as rotten on that side as this other side was. Basically, it's what I'd done. And I went in and I told my mother that I couldn't live with her because she had too many rules, and that's why I didn't get along in the Navy, and that's why I didn't get along in school, and that's why I didn't get along. I was in the Boy Scouts, I think, for 3 or 4 months. You know, I think I learned how to tie 1 or 2 knots, and that was my Boy Scout career. I just never finished nothing. By then, I had really started doing what we all do in this disease, and that was building up a lot of guilt, a lot of remorse, a lot of pain in my life. See, it was coming in. I was letting it in all the time, and I didn't know it. And I'd get up in the morning, and, you know, I'd think, you know, if you felt like I did in the morning, you'd drink too, you know. I mean, you know, when you tell your wife you're going to go down to the store and get some bread and there's nothing to eat in the cupboard, and you say, I'm going to go down to the store and get some bread and I'll be right back, and you don't come back for a week. You know, when you wake up the next morning, you're going to take a drink of liquor. I am. When you go in there into your kid's piggy bank and you take that rubber stopper out and you start fishing that money out, and you won't fish them dollar bills out because you don't want to go to the liquor store with all that change, so you fish them dollar bills out and you take the money out of that kid's piggy bank and you look down at that kid in that bed and you say, you know, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to put this money back, you know. And I take that money out, and I go down to the liquor store, and I get me a bottle of liquor. And I wake up the next morning, and I get thinking about that boy laying there, and there ain't no bread in the cabinets, and there ain't no money in his bank. And I'm going to take me a drink of liquor, because I got to, see. I got to have that where I can get along, just so I can look at me that day. And that's the way I was to live my life for many years. I decided that my drinking was so bad that I really didn't need a regular job. Because it was just nearly impossible to get up and go to work every morning when you're out till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and running the streets. So me and my brother, we decided to join all these other guys and get into the life of crime. And the life of crime back then was drugs. And drugs down, and at that time it was in the late 60s, and I was down around Piedmont Park. And if anybody knows anything about Atlanta in those years, it was unbelievable. You know, I had hair out to here. I picked my hair, and I was the only white man with an afro down there for a long time. And that old hair had bounced. You know, I'd ride around, that old hair had bounced, and I looked like a white JJ. You know, my face was like this. You know, it all sunk up, and I had bell bottoms on, and I was a mess. You know. And I'd go look in that mirror, and I'd think, boy, you're looking good tonight, you know. at that time, I wasn't very big, and me and my brother, we decided that we'd start robbing drugstores and go into business together. And that's what we done. And he even went to work with a burglar company. He went to work with a company that installed burglar alarms where we could learn how to do this business in a way that we could do it successfully for a long time and not get caught. And we did real good for a while. We burglarized so many drugstores that we started having to go out of town to do them. We had already hit Cobb County and Gwinnett and Fulton, and we started branching out, you might say, and taking our company to another level. And we broke into a drugstore out in Monticello. Now, Monticello only had 2 drugstores. If anybody's ever been through Monticello, you'll know when you go through there, if you blink your eyes, you'll miss Monticello because it's just a small town. But we had a driver, and me and my brother, and we decided up in Piedmont Park at 1 o'clock in the morning we was going to go to Monticello and do this drugstore. And we got in down there, and I was going to watch, and we had the driver up there. But now, what you got to realize is I was drinking, see? Now, when you're drinking and robbing drugstores, you forget stuff. You don't remember things like you're supposed to. And my brother said, now, you stay here, and you watch for me. I'm going to go in the drugstore. I'm going to come out. We're going to take the stuff. I'm going to hand you the stuff, and we're going to put it in this little old Volkswagen that we was in. And we're going to go back to town. And the driver's sitting there waiting on us. Okay, that ain't no problem. I can do that. I can handle that. Well, he got in there and he stayed probably 10 minutes, and I thought he'd been there about an hour. And I got to thinking, you know, that I'd seen one other drugstore down the road, and I thought, well, I'll just go on and get that one. And we'll have both these drugstores when we leave. So I did. I went down and left my post and went down, and I broke in this other drugstore. And the next thing that I remember was I heard somebody say, I believe there's somebody in here. And I looked up, and it was daylight. And they had opened that drugstore up for business, and I was still in there. And I thought, boy, I have really done it this time, you know. And that's about as funny as that story got, because I'm going to tell you right now. Them country boys did not appreciate us coming down. They took pictures of me, and I could hear the kids walking by the jail after school. This is a true story. They say, they got a junkie up there in jail. They got pictures of him up there at the sheriff's office. You ought to go see him. And I just really didn't fit in much down there in Monticello. And it was kind of funny. The judge said, well, I know a woman was driving because I saw her. Somebody saw her with earrings in her ear. They never had seen no man that looked like we did, I can tell you right now. So my business didn't last very long. And I'm going to tell you something right now. I did everything I could do to drink as long as I could. I had to, I heard somebody tell a story one day about, she was talking about her deal, and I was just like her. She said, you know, you don't have to take anything from alcoholics. We don't have to take nothing from alcoholics. If we just hang around them long enough, they'll give it to us. And that's the truth, you know. I mean, I give you my kids, I give you my job, I give you my right to drive, I'll even give you my freedom, and I'll go sit over in your jail. I wound up spending quite a bit of time. And I remember when I first came to AA, I thought, well, I don't belong here. They must have an advanced AA somewhere for people that's really sick, you know. Because these people didn't seem too sick to me, you know. I remember first, I just didn't really fit in with them guys. I figured everybody that drank like I did at least been in the penitentiary one time, you know. And I found out that I just didn't really fit in much there. And of course, my deal is I found out that it wasn't what we drank or how long we drank or how many we drank. It's how it made us feel when we drank, see? I didn't know that at the time, of course. I didn't know nothing. I thought I did, but I didn't know nothing. And my problem was that, I didn't know how to live without the drink. That was my problem. And my first AA meeting, my wife, she said, I'm leaving you again, and I'm going to take everything you got again. And I knew she could, you know. And any of you guys out there that think she can't, you keep drinking liquor and you'll find out she can. She'll get you guns. She'll even get the guns that you hunt with if she wants them. But anyway, I decided that the best thing I could do was just go along with this gig till, you know, she got over it, because I knew she would sooner or later, because we make our spouses awful sick. And I thought, well, I'll go to this meeting. So she called the Howe place up there and said there's a meeting at 7 o'clock. I said, okay. So I went to the meeting, and I remember I walked up there, and the old Howe place had a tax place across the hall from it, and there was a woman worked in there all the time, Martha, I think her name was. But she was an alcoholic's friend. She wasn't an alcoholic, but she was an alcoholic's friend. And I walked up that door, and I remember there wasn't no sign there or nothing. I tried to open the door, and I kind of stood there for a minute. I was looking around, and Martha hollered out across her desk. She said, did you come up here for a meeting? And I turned around, I looked at her, and I thought, well, now how'd she know that? I mean, do I look like an alcoholic? I really did. I didn't know. I thought, how in the world did she know that? And I didn't like that very much. And I said, yeah. She said, it starts at 8 o'clock. I said, that's good. You know? I done drank me a tall king size on the way up there. And I had another one in the car. And I said, that's good. Starts at 8 o'clock. I'll just go home at 8 o'clock, tell my wife how I enjoyed that meeting. But I really didn't believe it was for me. And we'll get through this thing. So I went out and got in my car, and they had a dirt parking lot, and my car was stuck in the mud. I couldn't get my car started. So I had to walk off and walk down to a friend's house, get him to bring a chain up there to pull my car out and everything. And I got all that done in about 7:20 or whatever. And I was getting ready to get in that car and leave and get me another beer. And a guy walked up to me and he said, "My name's David R. I'm an alcoholic. Did you come here for a meeting?" I said, "Everybody knows I'm up here for a meeting." Yeah. It's not a secret. Everybody knew I'm here for a meeting. And I wasn't even drunk. You're right, Billy. If wet alcoholics can't come to our meetings, where are they going to go? Where are they going to go? I don't do real good with wet alcoholics. I'm going to tell you that right now. It's hard to help somebody when you want to kill them. And I don't do real good with them. And I really don't. And my sponsor told me one time, I told him, I said, "You know, Fred, I'm going to tell you something. I went to help a boy the other day. I went to pick him up, and he was drunk, and the TV people was there, and he kept holding me up, and I'll be there in a minute." And I just left him. And he come running after me. Wait. And I just left. I'm afraid I'm going to kill him. And Fred told me, he said, "Don't do that no more." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Don't go pick up a wet drunk no more. You get somebody else to go." He said, "We need people here to help people that come in here to sober too." He said, "Don't do that for a while." See, he knew what to tell me about that, because I felt bad about that. And I say to you, if you can't deal with a wet drunk, get somebody else to go with you to pick this wet drunk up. We're supposed to have somebody anyway. But if you really can't deal with them, don't deal with them. There's people that can deal with them. You don't have to deal with them, you know. And I started working in the program. Now, I didn't pick up one white chip. And I know that you do not have to drink again in your whole life after you come to one of these meetings. I believe that with all my heart. But that was not to be for me. It didn't take me. I chose to take 5 years in and out of this program to get sober. And I'm going to tell you one thing right now. It was probably the most miserable drinking years of my life. Because I'd go by the meetings and I'd look at my watch and I'd say, "Well, they're saying a serenity prayer right now." And, you know, or old so-and-so's probably sharing right now. Hell, I didn't want to hear him talk no way. You know, because he usually starts sharing about 20 till and he shared about 5 minutes till. So I just had it kind of down to a science, you know. But you know what happened? I kept coming back and I heard somebody say over the weekend that the biggest thing they ever done in AA was they came back. So for you people that's out there, you people that's got to go back out or choose to go back out after you come in here, I say to you, come back. Don't stop. Don't give up on this journey, because this journey is going to work for you. You see, it's guaranteed. I hate to hear about people talking about statistics in this program. Well, it worked for 5 out of 20, 6 out of 10. You can forget that. This program works 100% for an alcoholic that don't want to drink one day at a time. 100% this program works. If it works for me, it works for any drunk in this country. And any other country. My idea about that is that you've got to come to get it, though. It's not going to come to you. You've got to come to get it, you know. I told Fred, my sponsor, I said, "I can't pray, you know. I mean, I don't like that word God. God is for weak and mindless people that cannot do anything on their own. So they've made up this fantastic thing that they can talk to help them out. And I don't need that. I'm doing pretty good. Look at me." Yeah. "You're doing pretty good." You know. I mean, he's really seeing me. I can't see myself, you know. He can see me, though. You know, we can see him. And he said, "You know, Mike," he said, "maybe what you ought to do," he said, "you wear the same shoes every day." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Maybe you ought to take your shoes and put them up under the bed. And when you get down in the morning to get your shoes to go to work, while you're down on your knees, just say, 'Thank you, God,' or something. Just say something to God." I thought, that's the smartest man in the world. Nobody could ever thought of that. He's got to be intelligent, you know. I found out he didn't think of it. You know, we don't think of much in here, really. Most of what we talk about is what we heard. Billy was up here sharing last night, and he was sharing about his sponsor teaching him how to take his money and cash it at a bank instead of a bar, and how to put his money in a checking account, and how to pay his bills. And I had one of my pigeons sitting beside me, and he's about 8 months sober, and he said, he looked up at me, and he said, "You sorry, dog?" Because we're just going through that, you know. I said, you need to do this, and why don't you, you know, we don't have no rules, but we got a lot of suggestions here, you know. When people call you, and it's 99%, it's always about romance and finance, you know, one or the other. And really, you could take a tape recorder and just, you know, when they call, just put it right there and say, well, just don't mess with her today, you know. We're not that smart. But he looked up at me, and he grinned, and me and him's been going over that very thing, you know. And when Billy said that last night, I said, yeah, that's the way I learned it too, was my sponsor taught me, because I didn't know how to do that. I didn't even know how to sign a check, or, you know, what you're supposed to do with a check. My wife had took care of that stuff, and most of my money stayed in my front pocket, you know. I didn't know how to go do all the things that normal people do. I didn't even like normal people. I still ain't crazy about normal people. You know? To be honest with you, I mean, I don't know what normal people... See, when I got here, I thought, now, what does normal people do at 1 o'clock in the morning? You know, I never see them. I've never seen one. You know, I walked the streets of Atlanta many nights hunting them, and I've never seen a normal person at 1 o'clock in the morning. What do they do, you know? See, I don't know what normal people do. So when you don't know what normal people do, you don't really get along with them very well. I came in here with the idea of saving my marriage, saving my belongings. I wasn't even real sure if I even wanted the woman anymore, but I did want my stuff. And when I got here, I had no intentions of stopping drinking. No intentions. I was not going to quit. As bad as alcohol was for me, as bad as my life had become. And, you know, I was the same guy that said, I'll never be like my father. Well, I wasn't. I blew right by my father. My father was an alcoholic, and he was more or less a bum. He drove a taxi when he could work. And I always heard that taxi drivers was people that had been laid off by the police force. And, excuse me, Billy. Actually, they said they was too sorry to be a police, is what they used to tell me, so they started driving a taxi. And I believed that. And my father, like I said, he wasn't in my life. He was gone early in my life. But what I'm getting at is, you know, my father did the best he could do. I know that today. My mother used to get us ready to go to... He was coming to get us. Now, we lived out in DeKalb County. He lived in Cobb County. And he was going to come and get us on the weekends, you know. And my mother would take a little old brown paper bag, and she'd put our toothbrush and a pair of underwear in there, you know, and a little change of clothes. And we'd sit out on the porch. And I've got an 18-month younger brother than I've got, just me and him. That's all it was. And Daddy's going to come get us, you know. And we was talking about what we was going to do. And then, he was going to be there at 6 o'clock that evening, and it'd be 6:30, you know. And my brother say, he's not going to come. I say, oh, yeah, he's coming. He's just in traffic. He'll be here. He's just having a hard time getting down here. And then it'd be 7 o'clock, and he'd say, he's not going to come. I say, oh, yeah, he's coming. He'll be here. You know, he's going to come pick us up. He loves us. He's our father. He'll take care of us. He's going to come. And it'd be 8 o'clock. And he'd start crying. He'd say, he ain't coming. And then I start saying, well, he probably had something to do at work. He had to, you know. And I started making, and I wasn't but a child. I was 7 years old. And I was making excuses up for this man. Already in my life, I'm making up excuses for an alcoholic that I don't even know. That's supposed to be my father. You know? And I remember I'd go back in, and I'd think about my mother. I said, why did you get us ready? Why did you do that? You keep doing that. Why do you keep telling us that this man loves us? You know, he don't care for us. And I got mad, and I made a deal, and I made this deal that nobody would ever hurt my brother or my mother again. Nobody. It didn't have nothing to do with me. See, I didn't care. That was my feelings. I didn't care. Because, see, I was going to take me a drink of liquor sooner or later, and I was going to get rid of all those feelings. I was going to take that drink, and I was going to get rid of every one of those feelings, and I'd never have them again. You know? But there they come. See, they kept coming on. And boy, I'm going to tell you right now, when I got to the point where when I was a young man and I was stealing and I was drinking and I was drugging and all that, you didn't really need to get in my way because I wasn't nobody to deal with, you know. I'm telling you, I would do anything for another drink. I wouldn't stop. I know you said that to me. You say, well, you wouldn't take my money. Yeah, I would. I'd take your money. I'd take your life if I had to. You don't say, well, that makes you a big bet. No, that makes you insane. See? When a guy walks up to me on the street and he said, give me your money, I'm reaching for money today. You know what I'm saying? I don't care if he's this tall. You know? I figure if he walks up to me and asks my money, he's going to take it. You know, he's got something in his pocket. I better give it to him. So that's the way I was. So that's the way I lived my life, you know. You're not going to hurt me no more. You'll never hurt me. But you better not mess with my mother and my brother. I wound up hurting my mother more than anybody in the whole world. Anybody, and my brother, too. Anybody in the whole world. I took my brother right down that road with me. We went down it together. And there she was, two boys. She done raised two alcoholics and two addicts. You know, I go to see my grandmother, and she say, son, don't tell me where you live. I say, why? She said, they've been down here three times hunting you this week, and I don't want to lie to them. She said, they got warrants out for you in every county around here. You need to come see me, but please don't tell me where you live, and don't stay too long, because they'll be back. That's the way I live my life. That's the way my life was to be lived for many years. And I had a wife and a child through all that stuff. And boy, I'm going to tell you right now, if anybody in the world didn't really need to have a wife and a child during that time, it was me. Because I was not a husband and I was not a father. I did not stop doing nothing that I was doing. And my life just got worse and worse and worse. And I'd have periodic moments in my life where they, you know, it'd be okay. You know, people say, well, I got drunk and I stayed drunk 20 years. Can't do that. I tried that. Your body shuts down. You know, your liver will quit working, it'll quit straining. Pretty soon your bowels will shut down, you lock up, you can't go to the bathroom, you can't take nothing orally. You cannot stay drunk. If you could stay drunk 20 years, I probably wouldn't be here. You got to quit sooner or later, see. I came into this wonderful program unknowing that it was going to change my life forever because of that God thing, see. I've had preachers absolutely hit me in the head one time. I was on a release from juvenile or something, and they put us in this body shop, and this guy was going to teach all us delinquents how to live, and you know, and they brought a preacher in, and he prayed one night, and I won't never forget it. And I done been dipped and all that. I done been baptized three or four times. I knew that didn't work. And this big guy come in that body shop, and all us delinquents, they lined us up, you know, and he said a prayer, and he said, do you feel the Holy Spirit? And he was walking down the line, and he was asking each kid as he come to him, and he said, do you feel the Holy Spirit? Well, that boy said, yeah, I feel it. He got to another one, he said, you feel the Holy Spirit? Yeah, I feel it. He got to me, he said, you feel the Holy Spirit? I said, hell no. And he hit me right in the head with the palm of his hand, and I won't never forget it, and he drove me back. And I looked at him, I said, you hit me again, and you're going to feel something, buddy. I'm going to dot that I for you, you know. So I've had the Holy Ghost nearly drove into me, and it just didn't do it. I want to take a little time to talk to the people that's just coming in this wonderful program. And I know there's a few out there at least. You can't get this many alcoholics together that when there's not one or two at least that's just coming into our program or just coming back. And that's real important to me. One thing I'd like to say is that just don't give up on yourself, for sure. Everybody that spoke up here this weekend, everybody that's attended these meetings, I remember it used to blow me away if people would pick up 5 years, or 1 year, you know. I mean 30-day people was my deal. I thought, you know, that was the miracle. But what I'm telling you is that don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on this miracle. Time in this program is not the answer. Time you got in this program. It is not the answer. It's not going to tell you what to do tomorrow when that urge or that whim comes to you about having a drink. Time in 10, 20 years, well, you got 20 years, you can't drink. It's time in this program is not the answer. We all go through the fire. Everybody in this room has went through the fire, and the fire is when you get here and you get those cravings and you get that urge and you just don't drink. You just hold on for another day. And see, when you go through the fire, you got to go all the way through the fire. See, we stop and put ourselves out while we're walking through the fire, and we just keep burning, and we keep burning, and we keep going back out there, and we keep doing it. And then finally we give up on ourselves, and we say, what's the use? It's never going to work. Poor Mike. I thought about Mike when I left here yesterday. You know, what's the use? It's not going to work. I've been here. I've went to that treatment center. I've been in that AA meeting. That stuff don't work for me. Go through the fire. Don't stop, see? Don't stop while you're in the middle because you're going to burn up. Get through the fire and then put yourself out. Let these people help you get yourself out. But one time in your life, let people help you because that's what they're here for. If you can't give this thing away, you can't keep it. Nobody's important in this program than the other person. Nobody's more important. The man that just walked in, the woman that just came off the streets, she's just as important as anybody that's walked in this room today. She's God's kid, and she belongs here. And you belong here. If you're just getting started, this is your program. This program was set up for you. See? It belongs to every one of us. Use it. Take advantage of it. Let these people love you back to health because that's all it's for. That's all they're here for. It's just to take a little time to show you something that you hadn't had in probably 20 years or ever how long you've been born. I felt so unlovable when I got here. I felt so much like a piece of trash. All that guilt and that pain and that remorse, and I couldn't do nothing about it. My poor mother, she tried to help me. Everybody, my mother about killed me helping me. Bless her heart. I'd sit down there in that jail, you know, and she'd say, I remember one time I was sitting in jail, and I was facing 20 years. I mean, it was my third time down. They'd already tried to try me as a habitual criminal, and I was facing 20 years in the penitentiary in the state of Georgia. And my mother and my wife came down, and it was Old DeKalb County Jail, and they hollered up from the parking lot down there and said, Mike. And I went to the bars, and my mother hollered. She said, Son, I think I got something worked out where you can go to a treatment center, a federal-funded treatment center for drug addiction. And I said, well, Mom, why don't you just get me out? You know, why don't you just get go the bond? And she said, Son, I'm not going to do that no more. And I looked there and I said, well, why don't you just get out of here then and leave me alone? If you're not going to get me out, don't even come back up here. Don't come and take that wife of mine with you too. Don't come up here telling me you're going to get me help. I want out. If you'll get me out, I'll go get some help. She said, I'm not going to. I said, well, just get out of here then. I don't even want to talk to you no more. Don't even come to see me. And I went over and sat down this old lifer in jail there with me. He'd been in about 12 years, and he was going to another trial for something. And I don't remember what, but he walked over to me. He said, what in the hell's wrong with you, boy? I said, what do you mean? He said, did I just not hear your mother tell you that she's going to get you in a treatment center and get you some help and get you out of this jail and you're not going to have to go to penitentiary and you turn around and run her off? Did you do that? I said, yeah, I done that. He said, you lost your mind. See? Even old convict knew I was nuts. You know? My life today is unbelievable. Don't do everything I did in sobriety last year because it might make you drink. Don't do that. But do what I've done for the last 10 years, what you did for the last 20, what you did for the last 5, what you did for the last year and a half, whatever. Come to these meetings. Don't come here, you know. I'm going to tell you something. I've got a friend. He's not here today because he's got a lot of back problems. And he couldn't be here. And he had a birthday this year. And I put in his card that I don't even believe God could have kept me sober this year if it hadn't been for you. And that's the way I feel about that man. I love him with all my heart. And I'll always be there for him. But what I'm telling you is that you can go through anything in this program if you don't drink. See, I kept coming to meetings through all this stuff. And I'll tell you right now, don't feel sorry for me about it because I brought it on myself, see. You know. What I'm telling you today, though, is I didn't drink and I didn't have to drink over it. I kept coming to meetings. I kept sharing with people that loved me and people that was my friend and people that said, Mike, just keep coming back now. No matter what you do, don't drink. You know. I got to the point where I'd have to pull over. I couldn't even drive my automobile. You can get in bad shape in this program. But boy, you ain't going to get no kind of bad shape like you're going to get if you pick up a drink, see? That's the deal. That's the whole deal. See, I'm no different than the one, like I said, that's just 10 days in here. I make bad decisions in my life today. I do have character defects, you know? I got rid of them one time, but boy, I got some back, and I'll pick yours up if you let me have them. You know, sometimes I am a character defect. I know today that no matter what happens in my life, I was trying to get sober. I was sober off and on for about 2 years, and my son went out one morning or one night, and he said, "Dad, I'll be back tomorrow." He worked with me, and I think I was sober 3 or 4 months, and I said, "Son, be careful. Come on back home, and we'll go to work in the morning. Get in early so we can go to work." And he said, "Okay," and they called me at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they said, "We have flown your son to Kennestone Hospital in a helicopter." And, man, I remember that call like it was yesterday, and I thought, in a helicopter? He must be almost dead. What's his injuries? And she said, "He's burnt real bad." And that's all she said. And, of course, my wife had already come up and out of the bed. She was listening to the conversation. And anyway, it was a terrible night. And we got to the hospital. Wasn't that far. And they were in there, and they were all over my son, and they were drilling holes in his head. And they were putting these pins in his head and all that. And I asked the doctor, I said, "Is that boy going to live? Is he going to live?" And he said, "I think he's going to live, but he'll never walk again." I said, "I don't care. I carry him on my back. You just save his life." And I remember there was a state patrol over him, and he kept talking to my son, asking him what had happened, because a boy got killed in that car wreck. And it was his best friend, and my boy was driving. And the doctor looked up at the state patrol and told him, he said, "Get on out of here. This is not the time or the place for this." And I remember right then, I liked that doctor. I said, "You know, he can get a police out of here. I'm for him." And nothing against police. I still probably need to work on some of that. But they beat me to death nearly all my life. But anyway, that boy, he could move one arm. And the people in the program just come to the hospital, and they take me to meetings. They go take me down to Elizabeth up there. I was at Kennestone. They take me down to Elizabeth meeting, you know, and old George and Big Steve and all that. And they come to meetings and took me down there. And Mike, it's going to be okay. And I lived in that waiting room. My boy was in intensive care for about 6 weeks, and I lived in that waiting room because they put a bell on his hand, and that's all he could move. And when he needed somebody to come in there, and what they wanted us to do, my wife and I, was to massage his legs and work his legs, you know, where they didn't get stiff while he was going through all these surgeries and all. When he got to rehab, he wouldn't be stiff and all. So I sat there, you know, and I'd wait, and I wouldn't leave. I didn't leave for about 2 weeks, and I'd wait, and I'd hear that bell ring, and I'd go in there and I'd work that boy's legs, you know, and I'd go to meetings, and they'd come up and talk to me, and everything was pretty good, you know, and I'd done real good. My boy stayed in that hospital for about 6 months. 5 months, 4 months, 6 months, whatever it was. And I didn't drink. I just kept, you know, doing things for that boy. They took him out to Shepherd's Spinal Clinic. And I remember the first thing the therapist said when they took his legs up, you know, and I watched that boy struggle just to roll over and to do things that he had always done. You know, he was an all-star basketball player, all-star baseball player, a goalie in soccer. I mean, he's just a wonderful athlete. And I watched that boy struggle at 20 years old just to roll over in the floor. And it would kill me. It just ripped my heart out. And I remember the therapist working his legs, and she said, "Boy, I don't know who's been working with this boy, but they've done a good job." And I just beamed, you know. I said, you know, it was me. You know what I mean? I'm trying to get sober. It was me. God didn't have nothing to do with it. The AA didn't have nothing to do with it. It was me. And I took all the credit for that. And one day, after about 2 months of that, learning how to transfer him from one wheelchair to another and all the stuff that you got to go through with that, and I told him, I said, "Son, I'm going to run down here and get something to eat. I'll be right back." He said, "Okay, Dad." And I went down to a Mexican restaurant, and I said, "I'm going to have me a Mexican dinner and a lunch." And I sat down, and I ordered a margarita. I don't know why. Yeah, I do know why. I know why. But I ain't going to tell you. You got to come back to another meeting, I tell you. I ordered that margarita, and then I ordered another one. And I didn't get blitzed. I knew I had to go back to that hospital. And I remember I drank 2 margaritas, and I hadn't drank in about 5 or 6 months. And I walked back in his room, and I said, "Son, you want me to get you up and out of that bed and put you in a wheelchair and roll you outside where you can get some air?" And he looked up, and a tear ran out of his eye, and he said, "Dad, I want you to go home." And I'll never forget how that made me feel. And I thought, how ungrateful you are. I've spent my whole life up here trying to take care of you during this wreck and do the things that a daddy does for a son, and that's all you got to say to me is you want me to go home?
How ungrateful could you be? And you know what I've done. Me and that boy's got the best relationship in the world today. He sells hospital equipment. He plays wheelchair rugby. He bungee jumps. He hand glides. He snow skis. You've seen these guys on skis with one ski up under them and all that. He goes to Colorado. Makes all kind of money. Won't give his daddy none of it, but I'm working on him. And he's had some problems in his life with his marriage and all since I've been sober. And I've always been there for him, you know. He lives real close to me, and we went in on a riding lawnmower so we could cut our grass and all that. And he cuts his grass, and he's self-supporting, you know. And he don't want none of your pity, and he don't want none. He's never asked me for one dime. He moved out of my house a couple of years after that wreck, and he's never asked me for one dime. I mean, that boy was really good. And, you know, that boy seen me off with other women and everything else and in bars and all that and the way I was. And my drinking affected that boy, and I know that. But God gave me another chance. He gave me two little girls. I got one 16. She might run me crazy, but she ain't going to drive me to drinking, I can tell you that. And I love her to death. And I got another one that's going to be 14 next month. And it's kind of like raising two families. But these girls don't know their daddy drunk, see? These girls, they don't know me drunk because they were just a baby when I come in this program and got sober. And I thank you people for that, and I thank my God for that today, see? That's the most wonderful gift in the world. Now, me and their mama don't always get along. We've had our difficulties. I love her too, but what I'm telling you is, like, no matter if I can be that woman's husband in sobriety, I can still be those children's daddy. See, I could never do that to that boy. Talk about choices. I didn't have no choice. I don't know about you, but when I got up in the morning, my choice was already made. Every day of my life. I didn't make no choices. I didn't even make a choice to brush my teeth half the time. Let alone whether I was going to drink or not. That was a given that I was going to drink when those eyes come open. In closing, I'd like to say that this is undoubtedly the only thing in the world that would work for me. Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing in the world that would have saved my life. I found out 5 years sober that I had hepatitis C, and I got mad about it. I said, I done all this. There I go again. You know, I done this and straightened up my life. I probably got 20 people sober and kept 10 of them sober for 6 months. And here this doctor called me in there and tells me that I got a virus that's probably going to kill me, and it's the number one reason for liver transplants and all this stuff. And I went home and I took a shower and I started bawling. I thought, well, I may not even need another bottle of shampoo. You know how we do. I mean, I do that sober. See, I do that sober. I'm serious. I thought, well, I may not even ever have to. I'm real funny about my shampoo. I don't like to use a lot of it. I like to. I got out of that shower, and I ain't kidding you, I was a mess. I was sober, and I was a mess, and I got down on my knees, and I said, God, please, let me accept your will in my life, and let me accept what's going on in my life, and let me accept the way that I'm going to live until I die. And that's the last time I've worried about hepatitis C. That was 5 years ago. I turned 53 years old the 10th day of this month, and the first thing I thought about when I woke up was my granddaddy, a man that I loved and trusted with everything. This man would not lie to you. I don't care what you've done, he would not lie. He called me into the house one day, and I was about 21 years old, and he said, Mike, he said, I got a problem. I said, what is it? He said, I don't think you're going to live to be 25. And I was shocked. I really was. I said, why would you say that? He said, because of the way you live. And I woke up the other morning, I was 53 years old, and I said, Dad Shockley, I'm still alive. You ain't, but I am. I'm sorry you're dead, but I'm glad I'm alive, you know. And I hope that you know that I'm clean and I'm sober and I don't live that way no more. Thank you, you know. I thought about my old granddaddy. Just always remember, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no big shots and there's no little shots. One shot and we're all shot. Thank you.